Lake Effect brings you conversations about what's happening in Milwaukee and the people, places, and organizations that shape the community. This is Lake Effect Spotlight from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
As we set off into a new year, many of us are looking back at the year that was 2024. That includes the Wisconsin Policy Forum, an organization that analyzes critical policy issues in the state of Wisconsin. They compiled a list of their top five findings of the year, and the forum's communications director, Mark Sommerhauser, joins me now to share it. Mark, thank you so much for joining us once again on Lake Effect.
It's great to be with you.
The first finding we're going to look at, I don't think it's going to be surprising for many people, especially if you have bought a home recently. The finding was that since 2017, home prices have far outpaced incomes in Wisconsin, making home buying more daunting. What does that breakdown look like?
Yeah, so I think you're right that that finding is not going to shock anybody who's even spent any time on Zillow recently. We looked at the median sale price of homes in Wisconsin during a period from 2017 through 2022. At that point, that was early last year, so that was the most recent data we had was 2022. And we found that the median sale price of homes in Wisconsin during that period from 2017 to 2022 had increased by more than 50%, by about 53% in just a five-year period, from about $173,000 for a median home price in 2017 up to about $265,000 just 5 years later. For comparison, during that same period of time, the median household income in the state of Wisconsin did increase, but it increased only by about 19.7%, you know, much less than that median home sale price.
So harder for a lot of Wisconsinites to get a home than it would have been 5 years earlier.
Yes, that's correct. So One way to think about this and one sort of metric that you will hear folks talk about in this space is the home price to income ratio for a household. That obviously can vary in terms of what we think about as being a sort of acceptable threshold, but the sort of general shorthand that you'll hear a lot of folks in real estate and other those related industries talk about is that generally speaking, a home buyer can afford to spend roughly 2.6 times their household income on a home. Prior to the Great Recession, our price-to-income ratio was relatively high, historically speaking. It was a little above 3. It dropped quite a bit during the Great Recession, down to a low of about 2.6 in 2011. And then it started ticking back upward, and it hit its highest point in at least 15 years. In 2022, it was up to 3.7, so well above that affordability threshold of 2.6.
Mm. Now, moving to the next finding. This is really looking at healthcare. Wisconsin is one of just 10 states that hasn't fully expanded Medicaid. And the forum's research found that it's actually the only one of those states that would have substantial savings by doing so. How substantial are we talking here?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges with this debate is that it often gets nationalized. The Affordable Care Act, federal laws, and federal programs. The reality is that the implications are very different from state to state. Each state has to make its own decision under the Affordable Care Act, whether it wants to expand Medicaid. And the financial ramifications of that are very different from one state to another, based on a whole lot of factors that we talk about in our report. But the real eye-opening finding that we came across in our report last year was that there are 10 states now that have not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. One thing to keep in mind for the other 9 states is that they would actually have to pay out more from state coffers in order to expand Medicaid. Now, there, of course, would be benefits for their state's residents in doing so. More of them would have health coverage, but state government in those other 9 states would actually have to pay more money in order to move ahead with that Medicaid expansion. Wisconsin is the only state where that is actually not the case and where it is actually the opposite scenario here in Wisconsin. If we were to expand Medicaid under the ACA, we would lower our ongoing state Medicaid spending by more than $500 million over the two-year budget cycle, about $260 million per year, in addition to, you know, the expansion in coverage and some of these other factors, as well as some additional upfront federal funding that the state would receive on a one-time basis if we were to expand Medicaid. So a lot of times this gets kind of nationalized, but we found it helpful to kind of compare the circumstances for our state to the other 9 states, and we found a pretty different picture here in Wisconsin.
Mm. So we're talking about a situation where we would be spending less money, or we would be getting more money back in our pocket and likely more people covered for health insurance. To me, it sounds like a win-win situation. What so far has been the rationale for not expanding Medicaid?
Yeah, I think initially some folks in the legislature who were opposed to expansion, this was kind of in the early period in the years following the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, there was a concern that it might be repealed, that the federal funding that the ACA provides to expand Medicaid would be possibly pulled back. Now, of course, we're, 14, almost 15 years after the passage of the ACA, it has not yet been repealed. So I think in the minds of some people, that concern is less compelling than it might have been, say, in 2013 or 2014. There is also a concern from our state's healthcare providers. They really have not taken a position of being either for or against expansion necessarily, but there is some concern about the reimbursement rates under Medicaid, which are quite low, especially here in Wisconsin. The rate at which we reimburse providers to treat people who are on Medicaid is quite low. It's much lower than most providers receive to treat somebody who's on private health insurance. And so I think the concern that you hear from some providers is that there could be some folks, they might have care through one of these ACA marketplaces, that they might now, if we were to expand Medicaid, be shifting onto Medicaid, and then their providers would receive a lower reimbursement rate to treat them. So that's one of the big issues that has been kind of a sticking point in this whole discussion.
Is there any political will to change this currently, or are we about at the place we were when this started?
I think when the whole debate started, we had Governor Walker. He was definitely not a supporter of expansion. Now, under Governor Evers, he's been a very strong advocate of Medicaid expansion, has proposed it in each one of his budget proposals. But I'm still not seeing much of a shift in the legislature. I know Assembly Speaker Robin Voss remains very opposed. There are much narrower Republican majorities in the legislature this year after the most recent election than there had been previously, but we still do have Republican majorities, and I think it's still difficult for me to see a path forward for a Medicaid expansion this session, although, who knows what could happen.
Yeah. So looking at one of the other findings, this next one sounds both good and bad. State and local taxes fell to record lows in 2022, well below the national average. What is that tax burden looking like here?
Yeah, so this was really an eye-opening finding, and I think it was one of our findings in 2024 that certainly generated the most interest and got the most attention. So if we take all those state and local taxes as a share of personal income, they were at 9.9%, and that was a drop from the year before, and it was a really significant drop from what it has been previously in Wisconsin. We call this measure the state's tax burden, and it has fallen both relative to itself and relative to other states. And I think the state's ranking is significant because it often comes up in a lot of discussions about state taxation. There's a lot of concern, I would say, especially among fiscal conservatives, but even among some folks of differing ideologies about if the state is perceived to have really high taxes compared to other states, that can be, in some people's minds, a real disadvantage in terms of economic development. And especially for some of your kind of older listeners, they'll recall in the not that distant past, Wisconsin was a very high tax state. In fact, as recently as 2000, Wisconsin ranked third among the 50 states for tax burden. And just in the last 24 years here, we've seen quite a dramatic shift. And in 2022, we had fallen all the way to 35th in our tax burden rank. That was by far the lowest on record. So this notion of Wisconsin being a high tax state, which was quite accurate not that long ago, has really been upended here over the last two decades.
Low taxes do sound good in theory, but this is also coming at a time when many local governments are struggling to make ends meet. What are some of the downsides for our communities when we lower taxes by this much?
Yeah, so I think, we already talked about some of the potential upsides, which, are worth taking into account, but you're right that there's definitely a flip side there as well. And, it's not a coincidence that during this same period when our tax burden has been declining, we also have seen declining spending levels relative to other states. We're spending more than we did two decades ago, but relative to other states, our spending levels have declined in some of these areas, such as K-12 education. That's always one that we're going to look at because that is really the biggest, single biggest share of the state budget. And we can take this same kind of ratio here and look at total state spending on K-12 schools as a share of personal income. And that has gone down quite a bit in Wisconsin. In 2022, it was 3.8%. If we rewind to 2000, when I had mentioned our tax burden was significantly higher, it was at 5.2%. So that is, you know, on a proportional basis, quite a bit higher of a share of personal income that we were spending on K-12 schools.
With taxes in mind, the forum's research also found that MPS leaders more than tripled the district's property tax levy for recreation in 23 to 24. They then lowered it again this year. Why did it raise so sharply and then drop down again?
Right. So this was one that we kind of flagged more because it just, there was not a lot of attention or public discussion about this increase prior to when it happened. And there are a lot of circumstances that went into the board's decision to do what it did. But this was last year, last fall, while the MPS board was considering the district's final budget for 2024, the board voted to increase a specific tax levy for a fund that most people, even probably even people who know a lot about MPS may not know about, but it's called Fund 80. It's the district's community service fund. And it's a special fund that actually goes for non-classroom activities that are outside of school hours, and many of which actually don't even serve students. They serve the entire community, things like adult education and recreation and things of that nature. The district did, as you said, voted to increase the levy for that Fund 80 very sharply from $34.7 million to more than $112 million in 2024. And it was really a response to a sort of unexpected finding that the district had made that the levy, the district's main levy to support school operations, which is by far a much larger property tax levy to actually support the ongoing operations of its many schools, was going to be far lower than was anticipated due to some changes that had been made in the state budget in 2023, which was enacted in July of 2023. And so that's why some of those changes were only becoming apparent to the board kind of in the weeks and months prior to this vote. Of course, we have had another budget now a year later. The district did subsequently lower that amount for that Fund 80 levy, but there was, you know, that really significant increase. Since that time, we have a little more clarity, I would say, as well, on where those additional funds are going to be directed toward within Fund 80. The district has said the dollars are going to be used to fund a new recreation community center and aquatic facility at the former Browning School and Browning Playfield location.
Now, the final finding we'll look at, it's another one that sounds both good and bad. Arrests by the Milwaukee Police Department fell by more than 82% over the past decade. On the one hand, that sounds like fewer crimes are happening. On the other hand, it sounds like Milwaukee police may not be pursuing criminals enough or as much as they were previously. Can you unpack what you found there?
Yes. So, you know, the way you kind of set it up there is fair. To give a quick rundown of the data, what we found there was arrests by the Milwaukee Police Department fell by about 82% over the past decade from 2012 through 2023. I think a lot of your listeners are probably aware that there was a lot happening with public safety during the pandemic nationally. And in Milwaukee, we saw this pretty significant increase in crime in 2020 and 2021. And before it actually did decline kind of in the years since. But the thing to understand about this trend with arrests by MPD is that this was happening before, during, and after the pandemic. So not to say that there was no interplay with the pandemic, but it's pretty clear that there was a lot of things that were happening independent of the pandemic as well that were affecting this. I should say, too, that there's all these other metrics that we looked at that really kind of tell a similar story. Police contacts with citizens saw a very sharp decline. Traffic stops saw a very sharp decline. Kind of painting a similar picture here. And as you said, there's a lot of different potential reasons for this. We know in the last few years, especially, that crime really has gone down. And so is there a link between arrests and crime? Potentially, but that number can also tell you potentially something about how the department is going about policing and how proactive they're being. We wanted some context because, again, there's been a whole lot of, frankly, kind of crazy stuff happening with public safety in the last few years. So we wanted to kind of ground this in comparison with peer cities. And what we found was that at the beginning of the period we were studying in 2012, Milwaukee actually had the highest arrest rate per capita of any of the cities that we looked at. And these were cities of similar size to Milwaukee and kind of somewhat similar circumstances. by 2023, our arrest rate had declined quite markedly, both in total raw numbers and a per capita basis. And by that point, we were the third lowest among the 12 cities that we looked at. So it does tell us that maybe at the beginning of this period, we were very much on the high end for arrests. And now we've seen such a sharp decline that we're very much on the low end. There are a ton of factors that go into how many individuals are arrested by Milwaukee police, you know, in a city of 600,000 people. And it's difficult to really isolate one or even two or three. A few of the factors that we were able to identify was the fact that, again, in the most recent few years, there has been, I think, a decline in reported offenses. There's been declines in staffing levels at Milwaukee Police Department, and you probably have reported on some of the efforts that MPD has made to recruit, because they're really having difficulty filling all the open positions that they have. There has been some significant changes over the last decade in MPD leadership and in the philosophy of some of the folks that have led the department, which we go into a little more in the report that I think probably had an impact. And then there's also this legal settlement that the MPD entered into back in, I believe, 2018, called the Collins Settlement. This was reached after the department was sued over its stop and frisk practices. And the settlement required MPD to record a lot more data and provide more justification for traffic stops, field interviews, other encounters with citizens that officers would make. And we do think that there's a great deal of evidence that has contributed to the decline in traffic stops and arrests as well. So these are all factors, and there could be certainly some more factors, but these are some of the things that we think go into those declines.
Sure. I will say, looking at your data, starting in 2012, it looked like Milwaukee was a major outlier as far as our peer cities that we were being judged against. But as you say, we're on the lower end, but it does feel like now we're more in keeping with kind of the average.
Yeah, I mean, I would say a little below actually now, but the context to me was very helpful in that we were somewhat of an outlier. I think that's fair to say in 2012 in terms of being very much on the high end. And we just have seen a really, really significant shift in the last 11 years.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work. And I'm looking forward to what's to come in 2025.
Same here. We're excited to keep, you know, putting out a lot more research, and always appreciate getting a chance to discuss it with you.
Mark Sommerhauser is the Communications Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum.
You can find more interviews like this one by visiting wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And while you're there, subscribe to the Lake Effect Spotlight podcast.